I'm going to go ahead and start. There will be other people joining us and sitting, but we want to go ahead and get this program underway. Welcome. We have a number of people outside of Washington, D.C. joining us for this extraordinary program. This is a good time to be in Washington, D.C. The weather is relatively clear. Even though the Washington Capitals lost last night, the Washington Nationals won. We're not used to that in Washington, D.C., of having our baseball team win. And we are now embarking on really this extraordinary program that we are in our fifth year of presenting this partnership between Environmental Law Institute and Vanderbilt Law School that really looks at the leading academic work of the entire year and both honors and challenges them all at the same time. But this really is, in fact, the best of combining, if you will, the innovative and creative spirit of some of our leading law professors in the country and then challenging them with some of the leading practitioners in the country. And that combination is something that everyone should be proud of. A number of people came together to put together this particular event, and let me just single out a few. Obviously, we have the extraordinary work of Vanderbilt Law School, and in a moment you'll hear from that leader, Kaki Talbot, sitting here in the front row, who brought together, and we have at least 10 different students of Vanderbilt Law School who really led this effort, really led the effort of putting together, thinking through all of the different law reviews that were available and then selecting the ones that they came up with today. So thank you. Thank you to Kaki. Thank you for that entire team of people who did that. We also have people from the Environmental Law Institute that was here, people from our environmental law reporter. Lindsay, where are you? Raise your hand, Lindsay. Please, Lindsay, in fact, was our person right here at the right front, my right front, your left front, who actually led this effort inside of ELI and assembled many of you here today. So, Lindsay, I wanted to thank you and then point out that senators are really valuable for many things. One of the things they're valuable for is to get us rooms. And the room that you're in right now is because Senator Mark Udall is on our board and was able to get us this room, which I very much appreciate, and thank you to Mark for that effort. But it would not, I really do have to now, and this will also be after I recognize some of our authors, our transition to the real leader of the pack, and that is this great association between ELI and Vanderbilt in the form of Michael Vandenberg, who I'll introduce in just a second, and then to my right, your left, Linda Bragan. They have other associations besides the professional one, but it is, in fact, Mike's leadership and Linda's that really have thought through it, and this is why we are able to be in our fifth year of this particular program. I also want to salute because they're here and because I know or honor or think of each one of them, the fact that we have with us today to defend their work, but to talk about it, Dan Farber, Jonathan Adler, and Doug Kaiser, who I consider to be an extraordinary trio of environmental professors and scholars and thinkers in the nation today. I just told Dan Farber that I wake up each morning with two things on my email. I wake up looking at the U.S. News World Report summary and his blog there. I was just with Doug Kaiser, who opened up one of the great programs where Yale Law School hosted a whole student conference on environmental law, featuring Mary Nichols as their lead and giving her a special award. And I came away just absolutely stimulated by that experience. And then I apologized, but I think you'll understand, to Doug, that I will not be here for his presentation because I will leave to do the oral history of Gus Speth, who fairly recently was the dean of the Forest School at Yale. And then Jonathan Adler out of Case Western talking about climate issues, but Jonathan and I were just comparing notes because we stood in line here in the Senate to testify not too long ago about the Rapanos decision before the Senate Environmental Public Works. But my point is that you really are seeing some of the leading academic thinkers in the nation. Their words, their innovative spirit, their creativity is exactly what this conference is about. But there's one more professor that I would put on that list, and this is my transition to turn it over to Mike Vandenberg, who leads the climate effort at Vanderbilt, who is the head of their environmental work there. I knew him both as a partner in a major law firm here, as chief of staff of EPA, a great scholar, a great thinker, and great judgment in marrying an ELI person, Linda Bragan. Mike, where are you?
Thank you. Thank you, John. In politics, people try to always get a small room so you can have a large crowd, et cetera. And I would appreciate it if you would deflate your introduction of me rather than overinflate it, because now people will think I can say something really smart, which I can't. But I am very excited to welcome everyone here. This is our fifth annual LPAR conference. It's done exactly what I think Linda and I had hoped it would accomplish. And let me just say very quickly, because we want to reserve most of our time for our speakers, what are we trying to do here? And a first goal is to help move academic ideas into the policy world. As all of us know who are in the academy, that we almost have a disincentive to write things that are readable, that are not footnoted, and that actually come to strong policy conclusions one way or the other. And our goal here is to make that more possible. Having been in a government position in the past, I know how hard it is to have the time to actually read the best work that's out there. And our hope is to create these short pieces with commentary that allow those ideas to make that transition from the academy to the policy world. A second is to improve the quality of the academic work that's out there. To cut to the chase, a joke economists tell about each other is, if you're trying to open a can, what do? You assume a can opener. Many of us in the academy do that all the time in our theoretical work. We assume a can opener, assume a way out. But if we've served in the policy world, we know that that assumption isn't going to hold true. Someone is going to be on the other side saying, hey, that's just an assumption. You don't really have a can opener. And so a goal here is to induce academicians to write policy work, in part to improve the quality of the policy work, because when it's being engaged with, as we'll see here, you can't assume away the hard questions. You have to engage with them. Another is to just provide incentives as newer professors come up in the marketplace of academic ideas to address policy issues. The first couple of pieces I wrote, the commentary I got back from my best advisors and mentors was, love the first two-thirds of the paper, cut out all the policy stuff. You won't ever place that paper if you have the policy work. And our goal here is to recognize when people do academic, highly sophisticated theoretical work, but that also has a policy implication or conclusion, as a way in part to make it part of the dialogue when people are coming up for tenure, when they're up for academic awards, et cetera, to create those explicit incentives to do some policy work. And then last, but perhaps first, on our list at the same time is the idea of trying to give the best possible learning experience to our students. Whether it's John Arcisi here, who will moderate the panel today, or interacting with our wonderful authors, selecting the articles, et cetera, we are trying to give students an experience they wouldn't otherwise be able to have, and I'm really excited about being able to do that. Let me say one last quick thing, and then I'll turn it over to Khaki. And that is, we are beginning to do an empirical analysis given the data we have. We review now 5 years in a row. We've reviewed all of the environmental scholarship we could get our hands on. And we're beginning to collect a database of the pieces that are out there. And just as an example, we know now that during the 2010-2011 time period, there were 904 full-length articles dealing with environmental topics published in the United States. And I'm sure that the top policymakers at EPA have read every one of them. But assuming that's not true, we're picking, of course, three today to present. Over time, we're finding some really interesting trends, and we're looking at things such as among the top 100 law reviews, what is the range of articles being published each year? And what we're finding there is it varies quite a bit from year to year, and that variability seems to be driven by symposia. that there are not that many environmental law articles that are published each year, except that in the top law reviews, except that they tend to arrive in the forms of bunches when symposia are organized, which is another important phenomenon. And we'll look more and more at substantive trends as we go forward. But that's one of the functions that we hope to play in the future, is to give the Academy a sense of, well, what is going on empirically in terms of the volume and types of academic scholarship that we see out in the literature. So that's what we're trying to accomplish. I'm really excited to have everyone here. And let me introduce Kaki Talbot, who is both getting a JD and a Master's of Divinity from Vanderbilt. And she is the Editor-in-Chief of the Environmental Law and Policy Annual Review.
Hi, my name is Kaki Talbot, and I'm the Student Editor-in-Chief of LPAR. I just wanted to take a few minutes to tell you a little bit about the process that brings us to today's conference. Every year, LPAR students begin with a global search of the top 100 law reviews and environmental journals for the word environment. After the students have chosen the articles that contain the word environment, the articles are culled for their relationship to issues of major importance to environmental quality, relevance to law or policy proposals, and persuasiveness. After this, students go through the articles, summarize them, discuss them, and with the help of our advisory board, we choose the final articles, which are presented today and also at our Nashville conference in February. After this, the students also condense the articles to a much shortened form, which you can find the drafts of right outside the doors. So we're very happy to be here and to see all of this come together, and we hope that you have a good day. I'm now going to turn it over to Linda Bragan, senior attorney for ELI.
Great, thank you, Kaki. Good morning. We're really ready to start. My job today is to move us along as smoothly as possible. We're already a little behind schedule. The format today is going to be as follows. The student editor is going to introduce the panel, then we're going to hear from the author, and then we will hear from the commenters. And then we're going to give the author a chance to respond to what he has heard. And then we will open it up for discussion among the panelists and leave some time for questions. So with that, I think I'm just going to thank you for joining us. It's going to be an interesting day. I read the comments last night, and some of them are feistier than usual. So I hope the authors are ready. I think it's going to be a really interesting morning. And I'm going to hand it over to John Arcisi, who is a third-year law student at Vanderbilt, to introduce our first panel. And let me also say, Michael Gu is going to join us. He's making a valiant effort to wedge us between a meeting with the administrator and a meeting at the White House. So he is going to kind of zip in, I hope, and zip out. But he will be joining us.
Thank you all for coming this morning. We're at the beginning of the end of the introductions. My name is John Arcisi. I'm an editor at the at LPAR, at the Vanderbilt Law School, and I'm just thrilled to introduce our first panel today, which is on uncertainty. It's an article by Professor Dan Farber, and it was published originally last year in the Georgetown Law Journal. Professor Farber is a professor of law and co-director of the Center for Law, Energy, and Environment at the University of California, Berkeley. And honestly, it's hard to overstate his scholarly contributions. He's the author of leading textbooks and other works in the environmental law field, including Environmental Law, Cases and Material, a textbook that many of you may have used in your studies. But he's also written widely in fields like environmental law, but also constitutional law, contracts, jurisprudence, legislation. And as a law student and a student editor, I can testify to just how often his work comes up in our practice. So it's really a pleasure to be here. He's a former clerk for Justice John Paul Stevens, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a life member of the American Law Institute, and we'd be here all day if we went through all the accolades, so we'll just suffice it to say that we're delighted to have him here to speak to us today. Commenting on Professor Farber's article, we have Alexander Golub, who's an expert in climate economics and environmental finance with experience in private and policy making sectors, currently project director for Metro Economica. Dr. Golub most recently served as executive director for global environmental markets at UBS in the investment banking division. And also conducted quantitative analysis in support of energy and climate policy for the Environmental Defense Fund. He's published over 60 peer-reviewed books and papers in some of the leading climate and economic journals, and his work's been cited by many governments, including Russia's ratification of the Kyoto Protocol. Dr. Gong Wu is a catastrophe risk analyst with Risk Management Solutions, and has broad experience analyzing all types of natural and made man risks. He's been cited by Newsweek magazine as one of the world's leading catastrophists, and is author of the book Calculating Catastrophe, published by the Imperial College Press for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And Michael Gu, when he gets here, is the associate administrator of the Office of Policy at APA. He's a veteran of EPA during the Clinton administration, and the former climate legislative director for NRDC. He's also spent extensive time here on Capitol Hill, most recently as staff director and chief counsel for the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, where he played a key role in drafting and negotiating the House-passed Waxman-Markey legislation. So we have a great panel, and I'll just turn it over to Professor Farber now.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and I don't think that's working. And this one? Oh. Is that working? Okay, it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm going to do my best to keep my remarks very brief. Sometimes that works better than others. I also wanted to thank John for that really great introduction, and to encourage other people in the room to take a look at the Legal Planet blog that faculty at UCLA and Berkeley do on a joint basis. My topic is dealing with catastrophic harms and uncertainty, and okay, so I want to say this paper is partly aimed at trying to suggest some useful ways of thinking about this problem, but also partly aimed at getting people to be aware of the problem and to focus on it more than I think we have in the past. It's not that this is a completely startling insight that there's a lot of uncertainty in environmental issues, but it often gets swept under the rug. So if you look at the public discourse, in fact, you would think from what politicians say that there's little or no uncertainty about environmental issues and their economic consequences, although they completely disagree with each other about exactly what we know and what we don't know. That is, some of them are certain that the policy will work out badly, and others are certain that it will be our salvation. Policy analysts are more sophisticated than that. They realize that we often don't know exactly what the scientific truth is about a situation because it's on the cutting edge of science, that we may not have complete understanding of economic consequences, but the traditional way of proceeding is to assume that that at least we know the odds and that we can then proceed on that basis. That's often a good working assumption, and I'm not criticizing the use of that in many contexts, but I think there are other contexts in which it becomes harder to have confidence in that approach, where our knowledge, even of the odds, begins to be questionable. And then the issue that I pose is, what do we do then? Okay, so unfortunately I used this title in an earlier paper, but Probabilities Behaving Badly would have been a nice name for this particular article. One of the ways probabilities can behave badly is by having what's called a fat tail distribution. And if you can see the PowerPoint, the purple is the normal bell curve that is so familiar and beloved of statisticians. The yellow shows what happens when you have a fat-tailed curve. It doesn't show the whole curve, so it's flatter in the middle, but then that weight gets redistributed to the tails. So what you see is there's a higher likelihood of extreme outcomes than we would expect from the bell curve. And in fact, the farther out you go, the bigger the disparity is. So the sort of wild card black swan events start becoming a lot more significant when you have a fat tail distribution. And there's a lot of very sophisticated mathematical work on this, which I'm not going to attempt to describe. Now, another problem that is, at least in my view, related but distinct, is the situation where we're really kind of up in the air. We're a bit clueless. We know something about the range of possibilities, but we don't have a really good basis for attaching odds. We can't even draw that curve that we saw on the previous slide. A couple of examples of this, I think, people could dispute the examples, but one of them is local effects of climate change. It's actually rather difficult to take global climate models, take them down to the local level, and make confident predictions about what's going to happen in a particular state, or let alone a particular county. The models are just not at a point where we can do that with any degree of confidence, even if we knew the future path of emissions, which we also don't know. A second is the risk of a future financial meltdown, like the kind we saw a couple years ago. These kinds of systemic risk events have been very rare. We're beginning to kind of understand what happened last time, but we can assume that probably the next one will be a bit different. We don't know how that's going to happen or exactly when. And a third is the risk of terrorist diversion of nuclear material or various other kinds of terrorist activities. And in fact, there's a report of the National Academy of Sciences that discourages DHS from trying to quantify those risks because the quantification is likely to be misleading. They relate, I think, although they are distinct problems, because fat tail distributions are difficult to pin down. It's difficult to figure out from observations exactly how fat that tail is going to be. We may suspect that actually the tails don't go out to infinity, but we don't know exactly where it stops. And one thing, at least we find with a number of kinds of systems, is that the reason it doesn't go out to infinity is that once you get out a certain way, the system changes into a different regime that has different characteristics and different operating parameters, and we don't know exactly when that's going to happen or what the new system might look like. So there's a relationship, although they're different, and I don't want to confuse the two problems. But nevertheless, I think as a practical matter for a policymaker in particular, they're related problems. So one way of dealing with them that's discussed in the paper is what I call the alpha precautionary principle. It's very simple. Almost simple-minded, but I view that as an advantage because policymakers are usually not very good at solving differential equations and so on, and I think having something that is intuitive and easy to grasp is a major plus. So this is a very simple formula. You take the best case outcome, the worst case outcome for a particular policy, and then you do a weighted average. And that's what you view at this. That's the sort of outcome that you associate with policy. The weighting is based on a parameter called alpha. The next thing you're going to want to know is how do we find alpha? And the answer is, as far as I can tell, we don't really know. But alpha does provide us a way to read into this problem both our hunches about what's more likely or less likely, and just our general degree of fear, optimism, or pessimism about the situation. Sometimes the exact choice of alpha matters, sometimes it doesn't. One of the things that I think is useful about this technique is you can try different alphas and find out, well, how pessimistic would you have to be in order to adopt this policy? Or, for example, how optimistic would you have to be that the scientists are wrong about policy, about climate change in order to do nothing, right? And that provides you a way of sort of thinking through the sort of degree of confidence or uncertainty that you would have that would influence your decision. So in some ways, this is more of a heuristic decision-making tool than a strict algorithm. I'm not going to run through a bunch of examples applying this formula, although I have some that I can that I could show later. I have a couple of additional slides. But instead, I'm really less interested in the formula as such than in getting people to think about the situations and about how we might deal with them. So let me talk about, let me say first a couple things about why I like this formula. It considers both the good and the bad possibilities. That sounds pretty trivial, but you'd be amazed if you, you know, look at the policy arena, not at sophisticated analysts, but at what's going on, you know, at the actual level where policy decisions are being made, how often people just focus on one or the other and assume that's the way it's going to be. A great example of that is we are 100% certain that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, right? You know, put aside questions about the intelligence and so forth. It's obvious, in fact, that you could, in an intelligence matter, I don't think you could ever be 100% certain of anything. But yet, nobody thought about the other scenarios. So it's very important to get people to think about those scenarios. This is a transparent approach. It's easily understood. It asks policymakers to focus on three key factors that they that can be easily grasped and discussed, and that lend themselves to public discourse. Okay. But let me talk about some case studies very quickly. First is climate mitigation. So we know with a high degree of certainty, although not 100% certainty, that climate change is real and that human carbon emissions are, if not the only cause, the major cause of the problem. What we have less knowledge of is just how sensitive the climate system is to CO2. That is, we can be pretty sure there will be at least a certain amount of climate change, but what we don't know is how likely it is that climate change will be even worse than that, and maybe dramatically worse than that. And the models don't agree with each other. There's a spread of results. And we don't know for sure that the models themselves are capturing all the possibilities. In addition, if we're thinking about the costs of climate change, we don't really know in the real political world how well adaptation will work, how quickly it will be adopted. And in thinking about the cost of mitigation, we don't really know the path of future technology development. If we knew exactly what the technology, the only way of knowing exactly what the technologies are going to be would be to know the technologies. And if we did that, we wouldn't have a problem. We could just apply them tomorrow. So I think that the cost-benefit analysis of climate mitigation is a very dicey proposition. I know at least one of the commentators is going to take issue with that. And I think reasonable people can differ. But when I look at the studies, they are all over the ballpark, from studies showing slight benefits from climate change to studies showing catastrophe. And if I'm a policymaker, I think what I have to say when I look at that is we got a situation where the best case is not too good and the worst cases are terrible. Adaptation is, in fact, even trickier because downsizing climate models is difficult. Things like sea level change are partly well understood. Changing the temperature of water changes its volume. Scientists have known that for, I don't know, a couple hundred years at least. But other parts are not really well known. We don't understand the dynamics of glaciers sliding down rocky terrain. And as a result of that, we don't know how much ice from Greenland and parts of Antarctica might end up going out to sea. Future global temperature is uncertain, as I've just discussed, and also uncertain because we don't know how much mitigation is going to take place. And so if I'm a policymaker, I think it would be a big mistake to say, well, we know what's going to happen to rainfall in my area. We know what's going to happen to temperature. We know what the frequency of flooding is going to be, and now we can just make our plans. We've got to take into account the possibilities that the flooding could be limited or it could be severe, the temperature changes could be within a given range, et cetera, and try to think about what decisions we can make now that will be the most flexible and robust over time as the climate scenarios unfold. And then finally, one that I wanted to talk about because it's a contrast case is advanced nanotech. So there, we really don't know very much about environmental health and impacts of nanomaterials, even fairly simple existing ones. We also don't know how much potential nanotech has for radical technological change that could be hugely advantageous, not only in terms of the economy, but in terms of health and other benefits. So unlike climate change, this is a situation where there are big risks, but also big potential benefits. And one thing I like about that alpha formula is it allows you to take both of them into account, and the first thing you realize is because you have these two quite different pluses and minuses for nanotech, it's really a different problem than climate change. It's a mistake to say, oh, we've got the precautionary principle that handles both of them, or, you know, otherwise to say, you know, that we've got that we're going to use exactly the same perspective to deal with both. These are really different, and our approach to a problem of this kind really needs to take into account both upsides and downsides. So just a couple quick closing thoughts. The fundamental point is just the importance of uncertainty, much more than the formula or anything like this. It is so easy to fall into the trap of thinking we know exactly what's going on. And there are a lot of political reasons to do it, because admitting uncertainty looks like weakness. There are a lot of reasons, like in court, to do it, because you don't want to say, well, this is a hard question, Your Honor, but I kind of on balance. You know, no, of course not. So we need to keep in mind, even if it's only behind closed doors, but I hope in the public forum as well, that we never know exactly what's going on. We've got varying degrees of knowledge and certainty, and we need to keep that on the forefront of decision making. And one thing I think we need to keep in mind that we've seen in a number of situations, like Fukushima, like the financial meltdown and so forth, is that the chances of an extreme catastrophic event may be bigger than we tend to think, just because we haven't seen one for a long time, and therefore we assume it's not going to happen. And one of the this alpha precaution is really just an example of scenario planning, which is a technique that business uses, the military uses, but we don't see very much in the public policy arena. It doesn't have to involve, you know, using some kind of formula, but I think it's enormously helpful for people to just sort of work through, here's, you know, two or three possible future paths of the world. What does policy look like under those different circumstances? How can I hedge against the possibilities of these very different future developments? And with that, I want to say thank you, and I also in advance want to thank the commentators for what I'm sure will be very interesting and challenging comments. Thank you.
Thank you, and I apologize for being late and also for having to leave early, but I'm very glad to be here. It's a pleasure and honor to be here to speak to all of you. Hi, John. How are you? I'm going to talk mainly about climate because that's what I'm most familiar with, and that's what we're most dealing with, although we are looking at the issue of nano as well at EPA. I'll just tell a few stories. During my travels around the climate change world and climate change mitigation issues, I found myself in Copenhagen in 2009 dealing with the climate conference there, which was in fact a moment of pretty high drama. President Obama flew in, all the leaders of the world gathered, and the climate treaty at a moment of crisis was resolved and moved forward. But there were also moments of bathos, and one of the moments of bathos that happened to me when I was there was that I was mistaken for Secretary Chu. by a high-ranking official. So, and I went along with that and pretended to be Secretary Chu for a while, until the real Secretary Chu showed up, and then I had to step aside. So. But for those of you who attended the ELI dinner, I'm going to start off in dealing with uncertainty by talking about, by actually quoting some of what Secretary Chu said at the ELI dinner, because I thought it was really quite instructive. And what he said in dealing with the issue of climate change and whether there is man-made climate change and what the catastrophic or potential effects are likely to be is that if you're buying a house and an inspector tells you that I've looked at the wiring and there's a 50 or a 70 or a 90% chance that your house is going to catch on fire, he said, well, you know, maybe you would get another inspector, maybe you'd get another two inspectors. What you wouldn't do is you wouldn't go and look for 100 inspectors or 1,000 inspectors and find the one inspector who said, this house is fine, go ahead. And I think that that's, you know, fairly instructive about what we have to deal with here in the climate change world, and thinking about the very large body of evidence that supports the fact that climate change is happening. It is real. It is man-made, and it is taking us on a very dangerous path. But you know, another way of thinking about this, I spent some time at the Natural Resources Defense Council working for a fellow named David Hawkins. And David's favorite trick was that if I did something he didn't like, he'd send me to North Dakota to give a speech to people about climate change. And a lot of those folks, the co-ops, the rural co-ops, heavily coal-burning folks, were not real receptive to the message of me, an environmentalist coming from Washington, D.C., to tell them that they couldn't burn the coal that was in their hills. And so I was confronted with this question frequently. And I ended up in some cases having debates about science with some of these folks in a setting like this, which is not really optimal for a debate on science. And what I came to over and over again was the sort of a frame of, well, what if I'm wrong and you're right, and what if I'm right and you're wrong? And so if I'm right and we take your path and we do nothing, then what happens? Well, then we have disastrous, catastrophic climate change, we have drought, we have weather system changes, we have national security or worldwide global security issues to grapple with, and it's at a point where it's irreversible. There's really nothing we can do about the CO2 in the atmosphere. One of my favorite factoids that I used to cite is that half of the CO2 that we put in the atmosphere in World War II remains in the atmosphere today. So these are long-term effects. They are not short-term effects. But then what if I'm right? And I think this is a critical thing to think about in terms of uncertainty. Well, what if I'm wrong, excuse me, and we do what I say, which is that we invest in renewable energy, that we look for cleaner sources of energy, that we invest in energy efficiency. Well, in my view, in that situation, we would still be better off. We would have still invested wisely in our future. We would have a better energy system, a more modern energy system. America as a whole would be more competitive. We would be better positioned, even if we did spend a substantial amount of money investing in cleaner energy. So it's just important to remember that while we have uncertainty about the effects, we also have uncertainty about the costs. And in fact, the costs frequently are overstated. We've learned that during our time in environmental law. And that, in fact, when we're talking about climate change, that the cost may, in fact, be negative, which is economists speak for saying that the costs are actually, that there is actually a positive effect of taking action on climate change. So we shouldn't just look at the probability of harm and then assume that taking action to mitigate this probability of harm will, in fact, be economically negative. We've seen, and in here I'll do a little commercial, but EPA recently in 2011 looked at the overall impacts of the Clean Air Act. And it's clear that EPA regulations, environmental laws are not fundamentally opposed to a healthy economy. Our study showed that The Clean Air Act provided $2 trillion in benefits in 2010 alone, over $30 in benefits for every dollar spent. You know, I can go through the litany of things that we have, that the benefits that are there that are quantified, reduce premature mortality, saving over 160,000 lives, 100,000 hospital visits, millions of cases of asthma, work days, so on and so forth. But if you look between 1970 and 2009, we see the total emissions of the six principal air pollutants fell by 63%, private sector jobs and GDP grew by 86% and 204% respectively. We can work on our environmental problems and grow our economy, and in the view of some, including me, those two things are not only consistent, they are complementary. And again, it is the case that costs have turned out over time to be overestimated. The acid rain program is a very famous example. And it's also the case that cost-benefit analysis, while it is a useful tool and we use it at EPA, it is not a perfect tool. Benefits frequently are very hard to quantify. And when we get into the issue of climate benefits, and this is discussed to some extent, the issue of how we value benefits to future generations is a critical one. And this was dealt with in fairly famous fashion in the Stern Report. The question is, should I today say that a climate benefit that's worth that occurs in the future, because the value of a dollar will be discounted, is worth less today, or is worth less in the future than it is today? And in fact, when Nicholas Stern was confronted with this, he made what was a controversial decision to adopt different discount rates. So that's something that we should remember. And it's also the case that sometimes our projections, just our projections about what's going to happen, what will happen in the world, are incorrectly pessimistic. At this point in time, we have historically low natural gas prices. Just 5 years ago, we were all very concerned about the dash to gas. But with these low gas prices, it appears EIA projects, in fact, that we will not be building new coal-fired electricity generating plants, because moving to a natural gas-based system is cheaper. And we've seen in recent years that we have historically high amounts of new renewable energy coming online. Still very small in terms of the overall portfolio, but nonetheless, the beginnings of an industry there. We are frequently told that EPA regulation on greenhouse gases will have catastrophic effects on the economy. And when I left Capitol Hill a year ago, people were fond of citing to me my old boss's John Dingell's phrase that EPA regulation of greenhouse gases would lead to a glorious mess. Well, in fact, that has not proven to be true. And in fact, it's my current boss, Lisa Jackson, who put in place the tailoring rule to make sure that as we do move through regulation, we don't do it in a nonsensical way, that we do it in a careful, common sense fashion. The nightmare that was painted by Mr. Dingell has not emerged, but at EPA we have not backed away from our statutory mission. We will continue to be portrayed in counterfactual ways. Every day we hear about rules that are destined to have a highly damaging effect on our economy. In fact, it hasn't proven to be true. I want to emphasize that climate mitigation techniques, and I've said this before, but can actually save money. Our greenhouse gas regulations for vehicles actually save money. They are estimated, and I don't have the precise figure with me here, but to save thousands of dollars for an average household family in fuel costs in 2025. So we should not focus exclusively on the costs. I guess I'm gonna just sum up here by talking a little bit about uncertainty. Because late in 2010, when I was still on the staff of the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, we realized that the Select Committee was going to actually be abolished, as it was under the new Republican majority. and we held a hearing. And the hearing was called Not Going Away. And our theme was all the things that were not going away, because, in fact, our committee was going away. we made clear, you know, that energy independence issues were not going away. We made clear that global warming was not going to go away. We made clear that without action, our addiction to fossil fuels was not going to go away. And so here today, to that list, I would add that uncertainty is not going away. In fact, uncertainty is embedded if we're to agree with Heisenberg, embedded in the basic principles of the universe. So we cannot know the future in all of its detailed glory. That's not given to us as humans. But nor are we completely incapable of foresight in action. We can know, we do know, that our actions have consequences, and that putting more greenhouse gases into the air year by year dramatically increases the risk of catastrophic climate change. I would say this is a very useful analysis, but let us not succumb to paralysis by analysis. Let us hope that we are equal to the challenge of uncertainty. Thank you.
Start by speaking directly to Professor Farber's paper. The whole concept of the precautionary principle is one which, in some senses, has had its day. It's a very blunt instrument, and it works fine in certain fairly transparent situations. If I can just give you an example, if you take genetically modified foods. Britain, the situation with regard to GM foods is quite different from that in America, okay? Because in Britain, there's no real advantage to the population in farmers growing GM foods. Europe has a very highly subsidized agriculture system, and there would be no price advantage to the consumer if GM foods were grown. But there is a modicum of risk associated with the potential for something very damaging occurring. And so this is a situation where there's a potentially large downside risk, and there's very little upside risk. And so we have a situation where the precautionary principle works really well in that situation. Now, if we take another example, take nuclear power, there again, from an environmental perspective, in principle, there's a large downside risk. We don't know what to do with nuclear waste. And the environmentalists would argue that there's not a whole lot of upside risk in the sense that there are alternative sources of energy, like gas, for example. Now, the precautionary principle has fallen short in that particular case because for a long time, the British government's view on nuclear power was no more nuclear power, period. This policy changed overnight. Why? And it occurred overnight when one of my colleagues' compatriots in Russia decided to turn the gas off to the Ukraine. Okay, because much as we in Britain love the Russians, we don't want to freeze in the winter because of a decision made in Moscow. That's not acceptable for a country with its past history of glory, such as Great Britain. And I see it everywhere here in Washington, of course. buildings like this don't exist anymore in Britain. So the precautionary principle as such fails in the case of nuclear power. If you take a case which happened 2 years ago when there was an eruption of a volcano in Iceland which disrupted air travel for months. The precautionary principle, ostensibly, is a good policy, namely, if there is an ash cloud, just fly around it. Okay? Don't fly in it, fly around it, which is fine for most kinds of volcanic eruptions, but it failed in the case of this Icelandic volcanic eruption. Why? Because the cloud was massive, and if you were British, stuck in the middle of it, you couldn't fly around it. Okay? And if the incident only lasted for a day or two, that's fine, you just ground your planes for a day or two. If it lasts for weeks, it's a serious problem. So the policy had to be amended, in fact, to allow planes to resume flying, even though from a strictly precautionary point of view, they wouldn't have done. Moving on to the question of what to do about it, again, I think Professor Farber has made a useful contribution to the toolkit for dealing with problems like this. For a subject as diffuse as uncertainty, it would be unreasonable to expect there to be just one or two tools which would be able to help policymakers deal with this. So having more tools in the toolkit is very useful, and I think the concept which Professor Farber has enunciated of this alpha precautionary principle is a useful addition to the box of thoughts on this subject. Having said that, if we come back to the situation in Britain, what is happening in Britain, and I think to a lesser extent in Europe, is that there is a transformation away from a kind of determinism about policy dealing with risk issues, more towards a policy which recognizes the need to be a bit more subtle about the way that these risks are treated. So in particular, in the recent months, there's been a publication by the British government on how to deal with these low probability, high consequence types of risk. And in particular, there's been a whole discussion about so-called risk matrices, where for each type of scenario, there is an attempt to quantify both roughly what kind of probability we're talking about, and also roughly what kind of loss we're talking about. And in fact, this work has been led by the British government's chief scientist, Sir John Beddington. And turning the clock back to March of last year, when there was this terrible accident at the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan, in contrast with the French government, the British government took a more decisive stand on what British citizens in Tokyo should do with the possible threat of radiation leakage from that stricken nuclear plant. The French government instructed its citizens in Tokyo to leave town. The British government, led by Sir John Beddington, undertook radiation risk assessment and decided that it was okay for the British citizens there to stay where they were. And in retrospect, that would seem to have been the right decision in the sense that the actual risk to the British citizens there was actually pretty minimal. So what we have is a situation where the way that a government can deal with these kind of extreme risks can be really quite more nuanced than has traditionally been the case, namely that there is sense in trying to quantify these risks, not in very precise terms, but even in just approximate terms, to get a sense of roughly what kind of order we're talking about. In a way, this kind of approach using risk matrices stands as, if you like, another approach to the kind of alpha precautionary principle that Professor Farber has been writing about. So John Beddington, whom I just mentioned, in fact, was the leader of the British team on the climate negotiation talks in Copenhagen. And I must say, the one thing I'm very proud of, speaking personally, is that he read the whole of my book, Calculating Catastrophe, over 2 weekends, and he said it was absolutely excellent. So if I can just say that I know that for many of you here, obviously, have not an extremely large amount of education in risk quantification. And if I could just say that my book was written for a fairly general audience, just to give you an idea of what is possible in this area. So I think Professor Farber rightly has criticized some of the literature on risk quantification. And what I in particular have tried to do in my writing is to convey the uncertainty in the whole area of risk quantification, what's possible to do and what's not possible. And so I'm hoping that this in a way is also a contribution to this whole problem of how can we help regulators to grapple with these really difficult problems which are faced, in fact, on both sides of the Atlantic. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here and comment on that extremely important paper that may have quite significant implications for policy analysis. And I should tell you, well, I will be talking about climate change because it's a field of my expertise. Talking about climate change, uncertainty was used by both end of discussion, like skeptics on one hand, and proponents of aggressive regulation use uncertainty as they want to argue for doing nothing, and other group for aggressively cutting emission. We need a good method to quantify risks given uncertainties, and I would tell that for a long time, so for a long time, we will be living in a situation when uncertainties are not resolved, but we need to make a decision. And selecting between 450 ppm target, 550 ppm target should be made basically within next few years. And we need to use the most advanced tools to analyze risks and uncertainties. Moreover, it would be naive to think that decision you made now will be the same forever. In case of climate policy, you need to be very adaptive to new information, new knowledge you accumulate, learning by doing. On the side of abatement cost, who knows, maybe it will be not that expensive to cut carbon emission, as well as on climate side. And I wish we wouldn't learn reaction of climatic system on anthropogenic emission hard way. I hope we will study that using computerized models and so on, and we will never have final and definitive answer what would be the damage if we keep emission on business as usual close to that. So that's why I'm afraid that a great deal of uncertainty will remain for a long time, at least on the side of climate policy, climatic system, and we need to rely on modeling results. Uh-huh. That's the next one. Thank you. Alpha precautionary principle offers a philosophical concept how to address uncertainty, and I like this paper very much, and I think that in order to approach economic violation of climate policy, you really need to differ from dominated in economic literature approach that focuses on expected value that basically wouldn't let you to understand magnitude of tail risk because it's average all together and gives the regulator kind of average weighted estimate. So you need to be a little bit more creative in order to weigh different outcomes of absence of climate policy or any given climate policy you try to assess. And alpha precautionary principle gives you the way to start thinking about this problem. And in some case, when you really make decision once and forever, alpha precautionary principle will be sufficient to make your decision, either reject or approve decision. But if you need to react on new information, you have to rely on more, you need to apply more sophisticated. That works. You need to focus on more sophisticated. No, it doesn't work.
It only goes backwards.
Okay, so let's try to, slide number 4. So, and what I'm want to say that if you extend this alpha precautionary principle and take into account other states of the world that could take place in response to our climate policy, then you may apply real options analysis for to assess one or another climate policy. And application of real option analysis gives you a possibility to take into account irreversibility, deal with learning, and moreover, to propose your dynamic hedging strategy. Because your climate strategy should be adaptive. You accumulate new knowledge and you basically have to react on that. And the way to react on accumulation, anticipation of new knowledge is to preserve some flexibility to correct your decision in the future. And value of flexibility is value of real options. When you prevent future, like if you basically select for next 20 years to be on 650 ppm trajectory, you have very little chance to switch to 450 trajectory because some options will be foreclosed for you. And then policymakers, when taking a decision, what interim climate policy should be in place, decision makers should take into account potential correction cost in the future. And correction cost is value of lost flexibility. That's why we come back to real option analysis. And can we have next slide, please? And then, next one, And then, of course, question is, do we really have enough technical background to apply real option analysis? And in order to apply real option analysis, you need not much, but still, you need distributions for key parameters that determine uncertainties behind cost and benefits of climate policy. And there are three major. Climate sensitivity, and on the left-hand side, you have different distributions. So there is not basically consensus which distribution is right, but you can use envelope distribution and accommodate information and discrepancy among different studies. Same about cost and benefits of climate policy, because then you need to know shape of damage function and you need to know distribution of cost of climate policy. And here I, on the right hand side, this is distribution of potential benefits in red and cost in blue of 450 ppm target. And of course, there is no single number to characterize that, but you have distributions, and as long as you have distributions, you can apply more sophisticated methods for analysis, or you can apply alpha precautionary principle. The difference between real option and alpha precautionary principle that you basically take draw two points from those distributions and have worst case scenario, best case scenario, and then you pick alpha that represent weight for worst case scenario. So in a sense, alpha precautionary principle is kind of simplistic version of real option analysis. And by the way, I like very much this part of the paper where there's discussion about scenario analysis, event tree with reference to RAND Corporation analytical tool. So that basically one way to calculate option value is to run Monte Carlo simulation. Another way to analyze event tree. And can we have the last slide, please? I think it works. thinking about policy analysis and climate policy, unfortunately, was not that much positive examples of application of rigorous analysis for climate legislation here. Only one example was regarding Waxman-Markey strategic allowances reserve. Then question was what would be the risk that price of carbon allowances would be too high. And then modern instruments for risk analysis was very helpful in order to understand what should be size of allowances reserved to keep prices in a certain level and so on. So, and to conclude my comments, I should say that it was excellent selection of the paper and it's very timely because I believe that we may go to another round of debates on climate policy. It may be again real, and we look forward for that. And we better be ready with relevant tools, because policymakers, they would like to know what would be the benefit. And if you tell, well, cost may be negligible, maybe next to zero, maybe even positive, are they not gonna buy that? Everybody knows that at least short-term cost, it will be cost on society. So what would be reward? And when you start talking about reward in terms of avoided risks, avoided damage, in terms of risk and return, then it becomes understandable for business, for Wall Street. And of course, we don't know exact distribution, but so Wall Street doesn't. If you manage portfolio, we really have no idea what really may happen in a few months, in a few years, so what's going on with economy right now, who can tell? It's gonna go up 5% or down, so no, nobody knows. You're always exposed to the risk, and you better measure that other than applying 2 sigma or 4 sigma approach. So you need really to think about some kind of worst case scenario, but you shouldn't overestimate role of that worst-case scenario, like conventional precautionary principle. And that's why alpha precautionary principle is much better. And it's probably one of the best non-technical work on that subject I had a chance to read. Thank you.
I just actually don't want to say too much in response because I think I ran over in my initial remarks and I used up my rebuttal time.
No, that's not.
We don't have a red light.
We are doing fine.
I don't know if this doesn't seem to be going on.
Yeah, we have a red light.
Yeah, it's not good. No, I guess it is on. Okay. All right. I thought the comments were very helpful. I'm continuing to work on the issue of uncertainty, and I think I've got some food for thought and some additional sources to look at. I want to emphasize the point that this alpha precautionary principle really is just intended to be another tool in the toolkit. And it's not one that's appropriate for all problems, and it doesn't displace the possibility of using other tools. So I think real options theory is a very useful tool when we have some confidence in the distributions. There are other tools like robust control theory that I mentioned in the paper. And I think these are really hard problems. I think it would be a mistake to limit ourselves to just one or two possible ways of dealing with them. I think maybe I'll just leave it at that and allow time for questioning. I am planning to tell everyone that Secretary Chu commented on my paper.
Dr. Gulliver, Dr. Wu, do you have anything you want to add before we go to questions?
Yes, in fact, in my commentary, I did make exactly the point that Professor Barber made, namely this is a very useful supplementary tool in the overall toolkit of instruments which can be used to help policy makers. I suppose one small point is that perhaps the name alpha precautionary is not as explicit as perhaps it might be as a so it might put people off, but there's perhaps yes. Classical education. But other than that, it certainly, as I said, this is a subject that requires a more nuanced approach than just the precautionary principle, which is a very blunt instrument. And nuance is what you get with Professor Farber, as I understand, in many more ways than one. So I must say, I join Alexander here in commending this contribution to the literature, and I'm very pleased to hear that you're continuing to work in this area. On the question of real options, it seems to me as though, in fact, your approach, Alexander, is what one could apply to many of these issues where there's uncertainty about the future. To what extent this kind of approach will make some headway with decision makers is not entirely clear to me, simply because it is quite a lot more complex subject than, as you put it, the simplistic approach of the alpha precautionary principle. So, in fact, in that respect, in a way, it just commends the approach which Professor Barber has written about, namely that his paper is one which I think even the most challenged decision maker would be able to understand. and in that respect, it's highly commendable.
Thank you. Dr. Gallup, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah. Is it on? Huh?
Yes.
Okay. And once again, I think toolbox should be full of different instruments. And then depends of how you're confident in the information you have and what is your time frame. Maybe you need just quick and dirty back on an envelope analysis. You need to have all possible tools in your toolbox, and alpha precautionary principle is simple but extremely powerful in my view too. So as for real option analysis, real option analysis has kind of its interesting feature when you can use this analysis and those estimates and incorporate that into existing market infrastructure. And for example, there is a lot of discussion about avoided deforestation. And potentially, if you think about future global carbon market, then allowances supplied by avoided deforestation could be plentiful in this market. Could be over 20 years up to 50 or 100 billion tons of carbon equivalent. It's huge. So if you just think about it like a tradable, easily tradable commodity, you may flood carbon market. If you start trading options on red, and then you really bring them to the market, those allowances, when you need to tighten carbon policy, and that you may need to do, because unlikely you will start this 450 trajectory and need to tighten climate policy all the way. Then real option analysis of shadow price of existing emission target would fit very well with market value of options on those offsets that might be a game changer over next several years in terms of our ability to commit much more aggressive climate policy.
All right, great, thank you. Do we have any questions from the audience?
So if we actually know the distribution entirely, we may, you know, then the alpha precaution is really just a very rough heuristic, and we may want to just use the distribution. But I think the broader point is that in reality, there's never a unique best case or worst case scenario in the sense that we can always imagine something worse, or nearly always, or something better. And so there is an element of judgment in sort of picking how far out the curve to go. And in making that choice, I think we have to kind of balance the sort of possibility that things could be worse than that with the sort of likelihood. So in other words, we don't want to, in a sense, what we pick as the worst case scenario has to kind of represent the possibility of even worse things going on, and we kind of do that. One of the ways that this sort of works out is because we're only looking at the extreme values, in a sense we're kind of overweighting both the top and bottom scenarios, but that over, you know, compared to the whole distribution, but that's partly because they actually represent a range of possibilities that are potentially even worse. But yeah, I think there's definitely an element of judgment. This is not a mechanical exercise except in, you know, sort of idealized situations where we can, you know, where we really know that there are only so many different possibilities. So that's one reason I think that there's a sort of a heuristic element about this. That decision makers also need to keep in mind that even this is not representing the full richness of the potential possibilities, but it's an attempt to sort of boil those down to the most manageable alternatives.
If I can just make a comment, I think the questioner was raising a very important practical issue, which is that for a wide range of alpha values, there's still a tough decision to be made. Okay, so whether the alpha value is 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, the actual decision is still tough. If you just take the what happened leading up to the Iraq war, because you mentioned about the, your figure was a figure close to 100%, because we all know the Cheney doctrine, that even if the chance of Saddam Hussein having a weapon of mass destruction being as low as 1%, that would have been justification enough to go to war. Okay, so if you had an alpha of 0.01, okay, that would have been enough to go to war. For other people, it would have been 10% or 20%, or some people, it might have had to be 90% or 95%, but Cheney, 1% was good enough, okay? So that, I think that was behind the question, that regardless of what these distribution curves are, okay, ultimately, someone has got to make a decision as to whether, at what point in a tail, you want to take action. So what's great about your contribution, Professor Farber, is that you've at least identified sort of one part of the problem, to pin that down, which is, okay, that we're not talking about, but worst case scenario, best case scenario, we're talking about something in the middle range, but ultimately, someone's got to make the call as to what decision to make if that alpha value is low, medium, or high. And I think that's actually a very interesting point.
Yeah, the one thing I would add is that although sometimes the decision will be very sensitive to the choice of alpha, sometimes at least it's very helpful to think about that problem, and I have a sort of rough calculation in the paper that's very crude of how confident, what would alpha have to be in order to justify doing nothing about climate change? How confident would you have to be given the potential catastrophic risks of climate change? What degree of confidence would you have that the scientists are wrong? And it turns out that you have to be very confident that the scientists are wrong in a way that I think would be very hard to justify even if you're doubtful of climate science. You have to be sort of convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the science is wrong, that, you know, that all these scientists are completely off base in order to justify ignoring the problem. And I think that's, you know, I think I've tried that argument with climate denial people, and unfortunately I can't get them to focus on the possibility they could be wrong. But, you know, I think for someone who's at all open-minded, that should be a convincing argument. Now the question of what policy response, how much it's worth spending, is going to be tougher and more dependent on exactly your degree of pessimism or optimism. But I think even expressing the problem in these terms starts maybe helping people think through, the robustness of their policy position and how much it's vulnerable to uncertainty.
Any other questions from the audience? Yes.
I have a question. It was a follow up.
So, in the political arena, I think that is probably, I would say, a more dominant role, although I think not an exclusive role. That is, although there are some people who would be reluctant to agree to climate mitigation, even if it were a virtual certainty that there would be catastrophe. Because of its effect on them. I hope at least, that there are also people who whose interests are somewhat opposed, but not so strongly that they would be completely unwilling to consider the public interest. I also think there are places where the balance of interest may be less clear than people think. That is, they see that there would be potential economic harm from climate mitigation policy, but if we could get them also to think about the ways in which climate change could affect their community or their area, that would at least maybe open up a conversation. I am more and more convinced, however, of your basic point, that the sort of people who thought about policy formation, I think, have tended to think that the big problem with climate change is that it's a global commons, it's a public good, there are so many different actors, therefore it's very hard to get an agreement. Same thing domestically and globally. While there's something to that, I think one of the things we've learned more and more of is that the real problem is this sort of distributional issue of who's going to win and who's going to lose and how do we handle that. That's a really hard problem. I guess if we could get to the point where we all recognize that was the problem, and we would be, I think we'd have made considerable progress, and I think actually politicians are pretty good at thinking about how to resolve problems like that, how to make deals that will get enough support to win. But I think we need to clear away a lot of brush to sort of get people to acknowledge that. I also think there are other contexts where the distributional issues are maybe not quite as dominant as with climate mitigation policy, and there's some role for thinking about, you know, maybe more of a political role for thinking about the public interest. But if I had a solution for how we make decisions in the public interest, even when there are winners and losers, I'm pretty sure I could get selected for the next conference. Yeah.
As for winners and losers, you can calculate who win, who lose, and arrange mechanism of compensations. What is more important is to know what is society get in reward to this policy, and then. Return and risk return analysis is important, because if you just take a central estimate, let's say $20 per ton of carbon as social cost of carbon, and then versus that $20 we talk about $30 carbon tax, so price of allowances you need to have in order to implement policy well, then analysis is not such encouraging. It's not in favor of climate regulation. But if you say, central estimate of social cost of carbon is $20 per ton, but risk-adjusted social cost of carbon is $50 per ton, that's actual reward that society would take, taking into account deferred liability of climate. And then risk-adjusted cost of climate policy is $35 per ton, then we can move to another level and figure out how to compensate. Risk analysis, you have to take uncertainties into account in that case.
One more question, did you want to
add?
We'll do two more.
It's a fascinating question, discussion, and we talked about the notion of a nuance today, and I think one of the questions I have is, no one would describe the policy debate that's out there as nuance in any way, and the debate you're having here is quite nuanced, and your question is really interesting. I'm thinking on one hand about the notion that what you're suggesting perhaps is what we think of as a beneficiary pay system, where those of us who benefit from addressing climate change redistribute in order to help those who might be harmed, at least in the short term. But you can look at the Waxman-Markey bill and almost having done that. And then it was criticized heavily for
Yeah, there are a couple of different questions. I don't know exactly, I wish I knew what to do about the state of public discourse in this country and about polarization. I don't really, except to say that I think one of the things that I think is important to do that we haven't done enough of, we meaning not just the public in general, but me and people like me, is I think we often haven't really listened hard enough or tried to understand hard enough the views of people who are on the other side of the debate, partly because it's sometimes hard to figure out where they're really coming from, because of the way people sort of spin their views in public discourse. But I think it's actually really important for us to try to figure out more about what's motivating some of the opposition and to think about whether there's room for common ground. And I'm trying to do that. I think there's been some very interesting research by Dan Kahan at Yale and by others sort of trying to figure out the worldviews that determine what people think about climate change, or to, I just saw a very interesting study about people identify as Republicans, what arguments cause people to, or at least some members, within that group might cause them to reconsider their views about climate change. And I think we need to do a lot more work along those lines. I do think that the redistributive issue is very difficult, and it is true that there's a trade-off between the kind of simplicity and policy cleanness that we would like to see and the really messy deals that have to be made in order to get things to happen. I tend to view that messiness as just part of the cost of doing business in the political sphere. So I'm not one who is terribly offended by the need to, have some give and take. And one of the things I think is nice about cap and trade, as opposed to a carbon tax, is in some ways, although in principle both of them are equally available for redistributive purposes. In practice, I think it's a little easier to do that with allowances. I guess, in a way, the sort of good old-fashioned political horse trading to me is less worrisome than a situation in which people are all standing on their soapboxes, miles apart from each other, and there seems to be no way to get them to the bargaining table. And trying to bring a little more nuance into public debate is very difficult. That's one of the reasons that I'm very pleased that we have Jonathan Adler on the agenda today, because I think that, just to give a little promo for a later session, that I think his work is a very refreshing example of somebody bringing a very different, from the point of view of the academic environmental law, a very different perspective to the table, but really engaging with the issues, and we need to have a lot more of that on both sides.
On that note, I think that Professor Adler had a quick question, and then we'll take a break.
Thanks for the question. But my question is I'm wondering whether or not we need to add to this discussion some consideration of uncertainty on the mitigation side. What I mean by that is talking about how to think about uncertainty in terms of climate change. But we could also argue there's a lot of uncertainty about the expected value of mitigation measures. And so, for example, the United States could adopt a policy that's designed to achieve 80 by 50, but there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not that will itself or trigger additional policies that would be necessary to achieve the ultimate goal of atmospheric stabilization. You could adopt an international treaty that could include legal commitments of some sort, but there's still substantial uncertainty about whether or not that agreement would in fact achieve what we want to achieve, and that's even setting aside any scientific questions about whether or not there are, still get poorly understood feedback mechanisms that could affect the way the progressive mitigation measures actually affect what's going to happen in climate. And I was wondering, what do you think, is there value in trying to unpack that as well? Because presumably we want policymakers to not only think about
Yes, I agree. I do think we need to take that into account. So, for example, I think that we really do, I don't really like the idea of geoengineering, and I think it's risky, but I think we need to invest in that as a fallback strategy to hedge against the possibility that either we won't be able to adopt the right policies or that either they won't work as planned or we, you know, as it turns out, that adopting the policies doesn't translate into action and that there are compliance problems are too big. I think we need to do that. I think we need to think about doing things that will bring down the cost of mitigation and maybe make it more likely that mitigation will happen, such as the kind of research that you propose. So yes, I think it would be a mistake to assume that if only we could adopt the right policies and if only we didn't have these other uncertainties, we'd be out of the woods. We've got to take, you know, this, in some ways I think, you know, it struck me that in some ways the kinds of decision-making processes we use in dealing, that are kind of familiar in dealing with human problems, with diplomacy, with military strategy and so forth, where you got to think about you know, a whole range of outcomes about will your strategy work, what happens if it doesn't. I think it's exactly that kind of thinking we need to bring to bear here. Yet at the same time, I think the risk is that, you know, we decide, oh, why even bother trying to adopt, get a deal globally because there might not be compliance. And I think we've got to avoid that too. We have to, you know, we have to be serious about our best strategy responses and not let ourselves be discouraged by the possibility that that won't work, and yet at the same time not put all our eggs in that basket. I think we actually are on the same page about that.
Dr. Wilson?
This is my closing comment. There's a homework assignment for Alexander and his colleagues, namely what the world needs is a meta real options analysis which takes into account all different possibilities in terms of the negotiations and how people behave, whether they keep their word and so on. What I suspect is that the result of this reductions analysis will not quite be as definite as your slide suggested, and I think they may not necessarily be that encouraging. But I don't know if anyone has done this. It's got a meta-analysis, but it would be very useful to do this.
Yeah, and it will bring us from field of uncertainty analysis to game theory.
Yeah, exactly.
That's good.
Okay. Well, please join me in thanking our speakers. It was a very interesting discussion. We will take a very short break, maybe 5 minutes. There's coffee and donuts in the back, and we will reconvene.
Other things I should read.
Read my book.
Yeah.